This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll get an update on flu season and what the hospitals in Kalamazoo are doing to try and contain it. But first, a new plan has been proposed for the former Allied Paper landfill in Kalamazoo. Some toxic material would remain at the Superfund site, but it would be contained in a smaller area. City officials say that would eventually allow for redevelopment of a portion of the site. We are joined by Denise Keel, a member of the Kalamazoo River Cleanup Coalition. She's also a professor of political science and environmental sustainability studies at Western Michigan University. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Gordon. Good morning.
And also Kalamazoo Deputy City Manager Jeff Chamberlain. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Jeff, give us an overview. What does this plan do? What would it ultimately mean for this former Superfund site in Kalamazoo?
Sure. Well, the Superfund site is down by Cork Street and Burdick. Right now, if you drive by, there's a big fence that says, do not enter, no trespassing, kind of intimidating. And we've been going back and forth with the EPA with a lot of community involvement about what's the future of the site. And originally, if folks remember, back in 2007, the idea from the EPA was actually add more PCBs to the site from the dredging of the Kalamazoo River. The community really got involved to say that's not acceptable. And so we've been working with the EPA and the state of Michigan to say, you know, what is an acceptable plan for this property? And ideally, we'd like to see the PCBs removed. It's part of our legacy as a city of Kalamazoo paper plants. This is where the PCBs came from. But at the same time, you know, we'd like to see that removed. And so that's been our position all along, is that we would like to see removal of these PCBs. Through the discussions, though, we've really also understood there's some financial constraints on it. And the city doesn't have the funding for total removal, nor does the EPA. And so what we presented to the EPA was an alternative option, which would be to consolidate the landfill, which is currently there, into one corner of the site. Cap it appropriately so that groundwater is protected, and open up some land for redevelopment for business, and at the same time open up some land for recreation uses. So we think this is an option that could benefit the community in the long run, but at the same time be in the ballpark of fiscally reasonable.
The news release that came out from the city regarding this proposal said that this option addresses groundwater concerns. How assured can we be that there would not be some sort of groundwater contamination from whatever is still remaining at this site?
Yeah. You know, we here in Kalamazoo get all of our drinking water from groundwater. So pretty much if you're in the city of Kalamazoo, or actually anybody around Kalamazoo that is on municipal water, you're getting it from the ground. You're not getting it from a lake or a river. So we have to really protect that groundwater. So nothing in life is 100% certain. What we want to do, though, is make sure that we contain the landfill appropriately. One thing, though, too, is setting up monitoring wells to monitor what is going on with the groundwater. And so that's been done recently. There's been some recent testing of the groundwater near the landfill that's there right now. And the good news is that it does not appear that we're having any contamination and it's not moving. So our plan is to make sure it's done properly and monitored for the long term. So if anything does happen, there's a lot of early warning because that's something we have to monitor with all of our ground wells around the city, whether it's a gas station, dry cleaners, even, you know, just your typical household waste can contaminate our wells.
You mentioned that the desired outcome would have been total removal of PCBs from the site. And that was the position of the Kalamazoo River Cleanup Coalition for a long time.
It was, still is.
And it was the position of city staff, elected officials. There's even been a song about taking
That's
all the
correct.
PCBs away from this site. So how have we reached this point where what the city is now proposing would not include taking all the PCB contamination away?
Well, I think still in the ideal, removing all the PCB contamination is the preferred outcome. There's no question about that. That would be the preferred outcome. You know, as we've been working with our elected officials, you know, local, state, and federal, though, we've also had to look at, you know, what can we accomplish? And we really have also maintained the position, too, that having a landfill with a big fence around it forever is not an acceptable outcome. So we had to look for what is a solution that could perhaps actually come about. And I think that's what we're trying to move the EPA toward, is let's have a solution that is beneficial for the community, but is also something that we can get done.
Denise, as you said, the Kalamazoo River Cleanup Coalition still the position is, let's get the PCB contamination completely out. So is the Kalamazoo River Cleanup Coalition on board with what the city's proposed?
So the way that I would describe our position is a lot like what Jeff just said. So absolutely, there is a 100% solution, and that's total removal of PCBs. With total removal, we don't have to worry about our groundwater ever. We don't have to pay the cost of those monitoring ever. So our position is right now that this is absolutely movement in the right direction. We are incredibly impressed with the city and the EPA in the movement that has taken place to add an option that gets to a lot of the concerns that have been happening on the site. For example, the fence is coming down. The groundwater sampling has finally been updated. That's 10, 12 years old. That's been a huge concern from advocates in the community. And really, this is a change in the process that we haven't seen before. The Environmental Protection Agency has been very willing to listen to this community, and that's in large part due to the elected officials and their support for total removal throughout the past, right? And there are good reasons to continue to support total removal. It's a fight worth fighting, is I think what many advocates in the community are still committed to, and there are lots of good reasons to continue to support that position, and many of those concerns are still included in this proposal because it's still a waste-in-place scenario. It addresses some of those concerns, but not totally, because that's what total removal means.
If total removal doesn't happen, though, in the next couple of years, and we go ahead with something like the plan the city has proposed, are we pretty much at that point committed as a city to the idea that there is going to be contamination there? Perhaps for decades, perhaps forever.
I wouldn't go so far as to say we also for sure know that it will leak and be contaminated, but the question is that we don't know. And what we are committed to then is an ownership and maintenance issue. There are going to be costs with the associated continuing groundwater monitoring. And I think there are going to be some different scenarios given this new proposal. It's a little bit different than the original caps that were presented by the EPA. This would make a larger hill and it would have some different engineering to it that I think a lot of folks are going to probably want some sort of mound monitoring to go on as well. So like I said, it without total removal, it keeps a lot of the concerns in place and maybe adds a couple more.
Is it crude in any way to look upon this as a negotiation and that the idea of total removal was sort of the first offer on the table, perhaps knowing that it was a long shot and that what has been proposed now is coming closer to what may actually happen at the end of the day?
I think it is fair to say it's a negotiation, but at the same time, though, it's also really letting the EPA, who needs to be making these decisions, know what the community's desires are.
Right.
And that's really been a big help from the community at large to say, hey, you know, we have a voice here as a community that, you know, just having an option of capping it or taking everything out, of which they didn't have the funds for to take it all out, you know, that we really need to look at, you know, what can we do to make this something better? And I think that's where we as a community have been striving for, is we do want to protect the groundwater. You know, we do want to address our legacy here at the city. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we look forward and that we're not just putting fences around parts of our community and just leaving them. Here in Kalamazoo, we have a very successful brownfield redevelopment program. Mm-hmm. And over the past couple decades, we've seen sites that were former polluted industrial sites now being used for some very interesting economic development and even housing activity around the city. And that takes a lot of work. And it takes working with our local officials, state, federal. So sometimes it's a negotiation. Sometimes it's just, hey, let's look at options that maybe weren't on the table to begin with. But the idea is let's keep looking at options to move us in the right direction. And that's what I think we as a community have been trying to press the EPA toward.
Mm-hmm. When there is a brownfield redevelopment project, are there times that there is some contamination still on site, or does that usually involve total cleanup before some sort of redevelopment happens?
Well, absolutely. A number of our brownfield sites still have contamination on them. And what happens then is it's a matter of how that's then handled. You want to address it appropriately so that that doesn't be contaminated as far as rainwater coming in and then leaking into a creek or something like that. So it has to be engineered and planned right, knowing what the contamination is. But absolutely, many of our sites here in the city still have contaminations, mm-hmm. even non-city involved sites. You know, there's a lot of commercial projects where an appropriate remedy is maybe removing some of the soil, but then capping it with what could be a parking lot.
You mentioned that part of the reason for this new proposal is that it's probably not realistic to come up with the money for total removal, either at the federal level, at the city level, or some combination thereof. So what are we looking at for costs in terms of this proposal, and who would pay for it at the end of the day?
Well, I think we were looking at from this hybrid proposal here of anywhere between about $57 to $67 million. Right now, the EPA has approximately $50 million for the site from the bankruptcy. It sounds like a lot of money, and $50 million obviously is a lot mm-hmm. of money. But when you're talking about large-scale environmental cleanup, that can be spent very quickly. And for the total removal, we were in the ballpark of $150 to $300 million. And, you know, if somebody in the community wanted to write that check, then that would be a possibility. We literally just didn't have the resources to look at locally, state, or federal for another, for instance, let's say $100 million for the site. It just wasn't there. But we've asked the questions. We've prodded everywhere we can. But this is, I think, in a ballpark where even above $50 million, if it goes to 60-some million, there are ways that we as a community, I think, can work together with our elected officials to try to fill that gap.
There might be some additional state or federal grants, in other words, that might fill a hole if there is one.
Right. And that's what, you know, we want to work together as a community to say, hey, we have this gap. How do we solve that problem next? And I think we can.
Are there other communities which have faced a similar situation like Kalamazoo is facing right now? And have they reached an agreement such as this one? Have they been able to find something where people at the end of the day were relatively assured about contamination and groundwater being left safe and that the drinking water was drinkable and that there was a redevelopment project at the end of the day?
So the word that keeps coming up here is community and community involvement. And it's really interesting because the EPA's own criteria for cleanup of these sites is first a threshold of protective, and then there are some balancing criteria, one of which is cost, and then a sort of mediating criteria is community involvement. And one of the critiques of the overall Superfund program has been that federal control over local communities and their decision-making process. And I think Kalamazoo is pretty unique in its ability to bring the community together and to do some of the things and get to some of the places that we've got in, I think, a negotiation is a fair term. So communities often don't have the voice that Kalamazoo has, and they don't have the elected officials to support them in that voice. We've had that, and it's gotten us a lot of what you see in this proposal today. Other communities, of course, other Superfund sites. There's about 1,300 sites on the list any given day. Michigan has about 70 of them. And it's across the board. It depends on that community involvement. And the EPA is always going to, though, make a decision that is supposedly protective, right? Our argument here is that the most protective solution is still total removal. And I think that I would make one point on the funding, the realistic sort of view. Absolutely, pragmatism is a bit of a virtue, and it's interesting. I'm a political scientist, so reality and politics often don't go together. So a lot of times I go back to the quote of politics is really the art of the possible, and it's absolutely, again, worthwhile for the community to continue to advocate for some other funding sources and to use this site, because we do have this strong community, to bring out some of the issues with the Superfund. Kalamazoo is a poster child of what we call orphan sites. There is no tax that supports the Comprehensive Environmental Response and Compensation and Liability Act. We call it Superfund because it used to be a tax and it used to be money. There is no federal funding for these. This all comes out of the General Revenue Fund. We were lucky to have a potentially responsible party. They went bankrupt. We got $50 million. This is what happens over and over across the country. So do sites get cleaned up to the very, very best of the protective threshold across the country? Probably not. And Kalamazoo is, again, the poster child for that. And I think community coming together to continue to bring those points out is a really good thing and can highlight a national issue as well as our local issue.
I can imagine some people hearing the idea of a proposed recreational site with contamination not being completely removed and saying, well, I wouldn't go there. I'll pick another park. I'll pick another place to go. What do you say to the person who thinks that maybe this is not the best idea, because who's going to want to be at a place where there has been PCB contamination and it's still going to be there even if it's supposedly very well contained?
All right. Well, one of the things to think about, though, is actually on the EPA's own priority list, they consider this site as one of the lowest because they consider it not that dangerous. Now, being not that dangerous isn't really comforting.
Relative, right.
Right. It is still the national priorities list. You don't get on this list because it's small change.
Right. Right. It just means that there are a lot of other sites which are more dangerous.
Absolutely.
Than
so part of this then becomes into the actual engineering of it, so that, you know, there's a large barrier between the public and anything that's contaminated. So, you know, if we're talking feet of topsoil and clay and some kind of liner, something like that, that would all be engineered specifically with that in mind, that it's not going to be just fenced in, that there might be people around it. And Denise brought up a really great point as far as monitoring of the site, that the fact that we could have people in the area around the site using it is a benefit for the long run, because you actually have people kind of can see something, so that if there's a bad storm and a piece were in the unlikely event were to wash out, somebody could actually know about it. There are also many examples, though, from around the country where this does happen. Mm-hmm. This isn't a brand new idea. I know just in my own personal life experience, there were landfills that have ball fields on top of them. Mm-hmm. And so it does happen. You know, we have a wonderful asset right in that area of the Portage Creek. And as part of the city's long-term plan is to have a recreation trail that will go along that Portage Creek, mm-hmm. connecting downtown Kalamazoo, its neighborhoods, and then to Millen Park, and then the city of Portage's Bicentennial Trail. And so that is part of this plan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we really think that it will happen. But at the same time, it just needs to be engineered correctly and can be done.
What's next? I mean, this is not a final done deal by any stretch of the imagination. So what has to happen moving forward for this to either become reality or for it to perhaps morph into something different?
Well, there's a couple of things that mm-hmm. we're planning on happening next. One, we need to make sure the community is up to speed on this new idea. And this is part of the process. But also, we're going to be having some additional public meetings coming up here in the first part of this year to talk about this idea. And also kind of the idea, too, you know, if we were able to have some kind of recreation here, what would people in the city like to see mm-hmm. in this area? What type of businesses would people like to mm-hmm. see in this area? We also need to keep working with the EPA, though, to have this actually put into their official process. Mm-hmm. And it's all handled by rules and regulations. But what they have is what's called a feasibility study. And right now there's really three options: do nothing, total removal, or cap. And we need to add this as a fourth option and to have them go through that official step. And then once that happens, to actually have them make the decision that, you know, something is better than just capping it and leaving it and doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Again, as Denise said, ideally, total removal. Mm-hmm. But we need to have this as an option and then hopefully on the table for consideration for a final decision.
Mm-hmm. And the final decision does rest with the EPA.
Absolutely. So, again, the way to think about Superfund is we are lucky to have a very strong community and a great mayor's office and city staff that have been working very hard on this. EPA is in control at the end of the day. So we need to do whatever we can to leverage the things that we do have to move that. And, again, I'll say Kalamazoo River Cleanup Coalition absolutely supports inclusion of this option into more options are always better. And this is a movement in the right direction. Absolutely. And we're very, very pleased and proud of our city staff for making that happen. And I think, yeah, moving forward, it's the role of citizens again. So like you said, Gordon, this community has been activists and, you know, really fighting a good fight for total removal for a long time. And folks are going to need to think about this. Folks are going to need to discuss what all the options are and learn more about this option. And it's kind of up to them, I think, to determine the best and highest use of the site.
Jeff Chamberlain and Denise Keel, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
Jeff Chamberlain is Deputy City Manager for the City of Kalamazoo. Denise Keel is a member of the Kalamazoo River Cleanup Coalition. She's also a professor of political science and environmental sustainability studies at Western Michigan University. One correction from that interview. In one of my questions, I called the former Allied Paper landfill a former Superfund site. In fact, it still is a Superfund site. I apologize for the error. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Centers for Disease Control has reported widespread flu activity throughout the country, including Michigan. The volume of flu cases led both Bronson and Borges hospitals to put some limits on visiting patients recently. We're going to discuss the flu with Dr. David Davenport. He's infectious disease specialist at Borges Health. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Give us an idea. How bad is the flu this year as we begin 2015?
This year's particularly bad. This is the worst season that I've seen in the last 3 years. It's probably due at least to two things. The vaccine is not as effective as it's been in previous years, and the actual strain itself is one that's historically notorious for causing increased hospitalizations and deaths.
You say the vaccine is not as effective as it's been in previous years, but if somebody has not had their flu shot and still has an opportunity to get one, should they do so?
Yes. It's one of the critical three-pronged recommendations the Center for Disease Control has. The vaccine is still effective for about 40 to 50% of the patients. And the 40 to 50% that it doesn't prevent the flu, it usually attenuates the disease. So if you've had the vaccine, you're less likely to end up hospitalized, less likely to have pneumonia, and you're less likely to be one of the unfortunate persons that dies from influenza every year.
Who are the people who are most at risk of getting the flu, and then who are the most at risk of having a serious case of the flu that could perhaps lead to death?
Well, there's two main groups that have the most influenza in any year. One group is the very young, and it's the children that are less than 2 years of age. And they're at high risk for influenza, and that's why the recommendations recently has changed for everyone over 6 months of age to have an influenza vaccine. Currently, in the United States, there's been a total of somewhere near 30 children that have died of influenza. And just last week, that was 15. So that's a group that we really worry about, and we're anxious to get immunized. The other group is persons over 65 years of age, particularly those that have underlying health problems. Those would be people with congestive heart failure, with chronic lung disease, that have cancer or on strongly immunosuppressive drugs. Most of the people that end up hospitalized have a number of other issues going on. At Borges, for example, last week, over half of our cases were on a cardiac floor.
Let's go back a little bit and explain how we reached this situation where we're talking about a difficult year for the flu or a bad year for the flu. Why is 1 year so much different, or how can 1 year be so much different than another year when it comes to the flu?
Well, the flu is, the virus itself is notorious for changing its outer coat, which means it kind of rapidly mutates. And the one that we're having now, this influenza A, which is called H3N2, is a bad one, but the virus itself, it frequently changes. The virus also infects birds and swine, so there's a lot of what we call genetic reassortment. So the virus slowly changes, and new viruses emerge because they have a selective advantage if no one in the human population is immune to it. And usually that slowly happens over time. And that's why every year there's a new strain. There's another thing where there's a dramatic change in the genetic makeup of influenza that happens every 30 to 50 years that causes widespread pandemics that we haven't seen recently for a long time. And people that follow the flu are real anxious that we're due for a major pandemic like the likes of which we haven't seen in the last 30 years.
And explain a little bit more about the vaccine, because I think people find this part of it interesting, that the vaccine itself is something of a moving target, correct, in terms of the flu that it's trying to inoculate.
That is correct. One of the hard things is most of our vaccine is produced in eggs, It takes about six to eight months to produce. So usually at the end of the previous flu season, a number of scientists get together and try to look at the different strains that have been isolated and try to predict what they think will be the predominant strains that will come out in the following year. So it's a scientific guess, so to speak. Most of the time, it's pretty good. This year, it wasn't so good, and we ended up with a vaccine that covers about 50% of the isolates.
We are speaking on Monday, January 5th. Some people are just getting back to work. Kids have just gotten back to school. Will we know more at the end of this week or maybe the beginning of next about how this flu is going to spread, since people are now perhaps getting in contact with more people than they normally do if they perhaps took some time off and weren't at work for the last week or more?
Very much so. There's two issues coming to play. Number one, when everyone goes back to work and back to school, there's a much higher chance that you will acquire the flu. You will be exposed to the flu. So we often see a peak in the number of cases of flu when the holidays are over. The other big thing is that there's often underreporting during a holiday season because of the people in public health and everywhere else are also on vacation. And they come back to work today, and they start to get all those numbers together.
I noted at the beginning that there were some limitations put on people visiting patients at both Borges and Bronson. Can you explain a little bit what those are, and perhaps if you can explain, you know, what they mean, why you put those limitations on people?
Above all, we want to be sure that flu is not spread in the hospital. People that are in the hospital are already sick and are already at risk, and we really need to do everything to be sure that we don't expose our patients to influenza, because they're the ones that are already at high risk. So one of the ways we do that is to limit the number of people that can visit. We also have a very strong policy of trying to educate the family members of what to do. And one of the things we do for influenza is we ask all the family members to wear masks, for example. The other important thing is that children frequently have influenza, and frequently it's harder to get a handle on their symptoms, and they are less forthcoming sometimes than adults. So both hospitals have policies about limiting children. Also, pregnant women are at very high risk, so we limit visitation to pregnant women as well. The other big issue that's actually occurred here in Kalamazoo and caused some real initial problems in terms of staffing, we had a number of our employees, a significant number of nurses at both hospitals that came down with influenza. So we had to be very strict about a policy of not letting them come back because we don't want to spread the influenza. But then we had staffing policies of covering all of our sick patients.
So it becomes a real double-edged problem there for a hospital that you have staff who get infected and they're sick. At the same time, you might have more people who need treatment, and yet you have not as many professionals who are there to help them.
That is correct. And ironically, for whatever reason, this year, the week of Christmas was the most difficult week for both hospitals because we saw what we call a huge surge in the number of cases of influenza at Borges. In terms of lab isolations, we had over 300 isolates in 1 week alone. And we had the largest surge of patients. And we had a significant number of employees, particularly nurses, that were out with the flu.
Dr. Davenport, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
David Davenport is infectious disease specialist at Borges Health. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.